I'm on live with Orson Scott Card. You're listening to Louis B. Free Radio Show, Brain Food from the Heartland. You can't look like this and be easily offended.
You have chosen to make your appearance memorable. But you look great.
I love that.
I'm a child of the 60s.
Me too.
And I see that your beard, actually, your whiskers actually go all the way along the sides of your cheek. I would do that if anything grew there. I have one little patch on the left side that grows, and on the right side, absolutely nothing from the between the goatee and the sideburn, and no sideburns. So,
this is more winter laziness than anything. The excuse I use is, well, you know, I'm not going to shave because it's so cold out, and
that works for me. Yeah. And there are other reasons for not shaving, like. I did that last week.
Well, you know, it took so long, Orson Scott Card, for me to grow any facial hair, and even, if you don't mind, chest hair. You know, I don't think I had chest hair until I was in my 30s. I'm more information than you need.
I mean, I'm in the exact same situation. My dad gave me a razor on my 16th birthday. I used it a second time on my 17th birthday, the third time on my 18th birthday. In each case, we were chasing like five whiskers. That's it. I could name them. I knew right where they grew. It wasn't until my 20s that shaving became something that I needed to do at least every other day. And so I grew a little goatee because that's what grows.
Yeah, that's great.
That's all.
Looks great.
Well, thank you.
I have to tell you, again, a lot more information than you need. But since we have that in common, I'll just say for me, my legs are hairless. And my wife said women would love to have that, hairless. I have very little hair on my arms, but my legs are absolutely hairless. And I've had actually people that have seen me in shorts, which is a rarity, say, do you shave your legs? That's how hairless
they
are.
You're bicycle ready.
So I'm assuming that's not the same with you. We don't have that in common.
Not quite. Okay. But you have to be up close to tell that I have any leg hair. So we're fine. We're just not hirsute guys, okay?
That's right.
It's not just a sartorial choice. It's also what nature gave us. You know, look, nature, nobody checked with me. Do you want hair to grow here? Do you want hair to grow there? The answer to all of them would have been, no thanks. Not interested. I was perfectly fine with my smooth, stupid body
that I
had when I was 9, and I would be content with that now. But there's just, you know, nature does
what it's going to do. Yes, I think I would have changed some things had nature asked. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm already loving this discussion with Orson Scott Card. It's been way too long since you and I have spoken, and I'm truly delighted and honored to have you back. I just had a wonderful, I'm going to say I had a blast with you last time. Every time we've spoken, it's been great, and I'm truly honored to have you back, and thank you for accommodating.
Well, this is fun, and the previous times we talked, it was just over the phone. It was radio only.
Yes.
And so I'm actually seeing your face today for the first time ever. And so and you're wearing a T-shirt that promotes libraries, which is a noble cause. I love my library. And it's
and
just kind of fun to have a visual image now and to
thank
see
you.
Your expressions when we talk.
Thank
it's
you.
It's the reason I usually hate telephones.
Yeah.
I don't answer the phone at my house. Somebody else has to because I just shudder. I loathe talking on the phone because you can't see the person that you're talking to.
Yeah.
And of course, driving a car and trying to do FaceTime or
sure.
Skype
yeah.
while you're driving. It
not
so.
Not
I
a good idea.
I avoid the telephone unless it's somebody that I know well, so that I know that if I'm offending them, they'll tell me. But I'm always imagining when I'm talking on the phone that every time I'm talking, the other person is going making some horrible gesture.
A finger in the mouth.
Yes.
For listeners, a finger in the mouth. Like,
yeah. And so instead of that, I avoid the telephone, except here I'm seeing your face. It's great.
Yeah, and it's great seeing yours also. And I love this medium. It's one of the wonderful things about it. Because I agree with you. I think you connect more this way. You're able to see the other person. You're able to connect. And by the way, this is one of my collection of library T-shirts. I had the former library. I wear what my big choice in the morning is, which library T-shirt and which jeans am I going to wear. It's not a difficult choice. And so I have my collection of them that the former library director asked if, she said, Louis, can you have your estate gift the library your T-shirt collection when you die, when you pass? And I was shocked because I didn't realize they had an estate. So that was that was the best. I said, I have an estate. I have something of value to gift. But I do. I love my library. I've got the library happenings here and reading. I just says when all the great programs, if you don't mind for a minute, that libraries across the country have for helping people read, helping children get started in reading, reading to kids programs. One of the things I love is they have reading to animals, they have reading to rabbits, reading to dogs, where kids don't feel like they're going to be corrected. They're able to read to a therapy dog or a therapy rabbit.
That is so vital. My older daughter, when she was in elementary school, they had a great program for the first graders. There was lots wrong with the various schools, but in first grade, they had free writing and not a mark on the page. You made up how to spell the words. They taught them phonics, which is the only way to teach reading. And so they would just accept whatever they wrote. And because of that, she was allowed to become a fluid a natural writer. She writes like she talks. And she's now just an amazingly talented writer because she never had anything blocking her. She never felt that she wasn't free to write as she speaks. And the same thing, she not only reads fluently, she makes a living at it. She is an audiobook narrator.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
How old, do you mind if I ask?
Well, actually, my wife is there where she lives in California, taking care of her first two daughters.
Oh, congratulations.
So that she can go have child number three. And so we're waiting any minute now. The baby has been, the doctors announced 2 weeks ago, this baby's big enough. You know, this we guessed wrong on the date. Obviously, the baby's full term. Well, 2 weeks later, the baby is just playing, you know, it's hard to get, you know. All of the, you know, you're told, oh, you're dilated to this, you're dilated to that, and she gets labor pains, just one, and then nothing for another 24 hours. So at some point, they're just going to induce, because there's a point where children who have any of my genes in them end up having such an enormous head that there is no hope for them having a normal birth.
So that's something else we have in common. So,
yeah, I mean, well, you don't look like you have a huge
head.
Well,
neither do you.
But I cannot buy a hat. I mean, no store has my size. I have found over the years about a dozen hats so that I can put a cap on my head that's not, you know, I can't even wear those baseball caps that have an adjustable back. They don't adjust far enough. So they end up
tabs
on
open.
Top of my head. And so hats are a, you know, I love wearing them, but getting any that fit because my head's so big. Well, my kids have all not cursed me. They don't use that kind of language. But they have expressed regret that they had to get that particular gene from me. And all of their kids are also fairly large-headed. Yeah. And so it's just something that goes on through the generations.
It makes the birth canal the difficulty, I'm sure.
It's always amusing, but nevertheless, my son found a wife knowing the size of his head. And so it's not like that's something you can conceal.
Oh, that's wonderful. Did you say your daughter is also a writer?
She is. She's a very good writer. She writes, has written screenplays. She's working on a couple of novels. Has one under contract as a collaboration with me, as a matter of fact. And so when she was a kid, and this is how you find out you got a writer. Whenever on the family computer in the library, which is a bedroom that we converted into a library, instead of closets, we took out all the closety stuff and put in a desk height counter that is the desk. and that had the family computer. And so whenever I would install a new font, because I'm font crazy, I love fonts. I've got to have my Bookman. I've got to have my Book Antiqua, my Palatino, et cetera, et cetera. Got to have my fonts. And so whenever I'd install a new font, she would notice, she would try it out, and she'd try it out by writing the opening to a sarcastic, hilarious story or a fantastical magic story or whatever she is in the mood for. And she would just type till she was tired, and sometimes she would delete it. Most of the time, she just walked away and left it. My wife and I would save them. She didn't save them on the word processor, but we would save them because she sounded, at 8 and 9, she sounded like an adult. She handled viewpoint like a professional writer, which is really the separation between the pros and the amateurs, is if you can handle viewpoint properly, then editors don't give you rejection notes. They write back and say, I'm not buying this story, but please send me everything you write because you sound like a pro. And so it seems that you're likely to give them good stuff. So she's in that category. Wow. That even when she's playing, she writes professional quality work. When she was, what age? About 10, I believe, in little school that we got her to, and then editors don't, they took part in a contest, the school did, and every child was supposed to write a story. Well, she wrote a story, but she didn't win. And I thought, good heavens, I want to read the entry of the kid that did win. Well, here's the problem. They assumed I had written it for her.
Wow. Go ahead.
I mean, they honestly believed it. And so we had to go to the school and affirm. I never saw her story until standing at the doorway as she left to go to school the day she turned it in. I read it then, said, great job, Emily. And that was the extent of my input. So people leap to conclusions. They assume that everybody's dishonest, I guess. But no, it was absolutely her work. So they didn't take it away from the kid who they had given the award to. They just allowed her to attend all the same events because clearly she would have won. She writes like an adult professional.
Well,
so
they thought you wrote it, no doubt. That's how that had to make you feel. She may have felt that she didn't, it had to make you feel
well. But the
fabulous.
Nice thing is, her ego just wasn't in it. She actually didn't care that she hadn't won. So she wouldn't go to the events, young writer events, big deal. It just wasn't that important to her. If she had gone down the road of being an actress, she could be nominated for an Oscar and have no idea whether she even wanted to show up. That's her. So,
well, I think that's wonderful also, because the ego won't get in the way, her ego.
Well, the nice thing is I have two daughters. And while both of them look absolutely fabulous in clothes and they enjoy looking good, neither one will spend money on clothing. Neither one.
Wow.
My youngest, has the form to be a model. Nevertheless, how many people have teenage daughters who love clothes who would have this conversation? This is mom talking to the youngest.
Okay.
And she says, okay, now, darling, you know we can afford this. It's not even that expensive. Oh, but I'd never wear it more than once. Why bother? and she refused to buy it. And so, how many of those conversations do people have?
Next to none. I'm guessing they usually go the other way, where the teenager said, yeah.
But the thing is, they've never cared about the stuff that comes with money. Now, we've never, we're not fabulously wealthy. I'm not Stephen King, for heaven's sake. I'm certainly not J.K. Rowling. And so we have a decent income, but we can afford to buy some clothes. And so we have to basically beat our kids with a stick to make them let us spend money on them. And so, it makes Christmas hard. They don't need anything. They don't want anything. So, if they don't make an Amazon wish list, we're really flummoxed.
But they've got the love and they've got the security and they've got the intelligence
Just is not invested in their clothing. And labels mean nothing to them. Part of that is that in our family we never cared about labels. In fact, they know that I won't wear any brand that puts their logo on my shirt. If the logo's in a prominent place, I'm never buying anything from them, because I'm not a billboard, and so I'm not interested in advertising their wares.
When you say that, it makes me think of an article that I read in the last couple of days about at a school somewhere. I think it's somewhere in New York, where they were asking parents to not let their kids wear this $350 beanie hat. I don't know. I used to call it like a watch cap with a little ball on top. $350 because they were getting lost, stolen, misplaced, whatever, and it was wreaking havoc. I think about when you talk about the logos. I remember a few decades ago when there was violence on streets because kids were getting beaten, in some cases shot, for their tennis shoes because of the label or because of what celebrity wore them. Outrageous.
When I got into running about 20 years ago, I got into walking, and then I found it boring, and I'd gotten into good enough shape that I could run. So I would, I started running 10 steps at a time, and it finally got so that I ran. But let's put "run" in quotation marks here. My gait was actually a running gait, but it was the slowest run you could imagine. Let's just say that not just cheetahs could catch me, but also turtles. Anyway, I was running, and I tried some of those brand name shoes, and they were horrible. They were savage to my knees. And I ended up buying New Balance. I used them for a long time. Now I wear Zero shoes, XERO, which are really comfortable with Protolis inserts. I'm not trying to do an ad here. I'm just saying that you've never heard of these brands, or most people haven't, and they don't plaster their logo all over the clothes. New Balance has an N on their shoe. But it doesn't, it doesn't stand out. It's not the Nike swoosh. It's not, So I'm content, plus they're better. I buy for comfort. Now, if Nike was the only one that worked with my body and that was comfortable,
sure,
I'd wear it. I'd try to find something without high contrast in the logo. But you got to realize, as an overweight guy, you don't have this problem. You are obviously in great shape. Believe me. You have the body I wanted to grow up to have. So anyway,
you're too kind and generous.
I've lost about 60 pounds in the last couple of years.
That's great.
So I'm back down to kind of something more normal in size. But I've spent most of my adult life shopping in big and tall stores. And for the first 15, 20 years of buying clothes there, I have an allergy to both wool and polyester. I can't wear any polyester. I can wear acrylic, I can wear nylon, not polyester. And basically, there seemed to be a law in the clothing industry that fat people were forbidden to wear cotton. It was just not allowed. You always had to have polyester in everything. So I'd go to the big and tall stores, and it would be years between my ability to buy shirts because everything had polyester. Now, it's different now, for one thing. The baby boom generation got fat, and we had all the money. And so they realized that if the baby boom generation wanted cotton, they would profit by making cotton items for us. So now it's not that big a problem buying good shirts. Plus, there are stores where you can't find the polyester concentration they used to have. But for a long time, it was a long time before I even discovered it was polyester causing the itching and the rashes. But I've gotten to the point where everything I need, I can get, which is amazing. But sure as I find a product I love, they discontinue it. Absolutely, all the time. I'm sitting here with bottles of Hint water because that's what I love to drink. I buy it by the case, mail order, because the stores are not reliable locally to have Hint water. Not the carbonated Hint, but the regular plain Hint. It really is just a touch of the flavor, and I absolutely love it. I am so surprised that they have not yet gone out of business, because I'm so dependent on my Hint water that it's just unbelievable to me that they have not had to close up shop, because everything else I love goes away.
I know that. Go ahead.
Well, Wallaby brand yogurt was perfect for me. I bought the kinds that didn't have chunks of fruit, because that just makes me want to gag. I just like totally smooth. There was a perfect blend of flavor. It was delicious. It was wonderful. And then suddenly some moron somewhere decided that the only yogurt people should have is Greek-style yogurt.
Yeah, yeah.
And that... it's vile. It's vile. I would rather eat school paste than that. And all of a sudden, the shelves were filled with Greek yogurt, and my Wallaby brand disappeared.
Gone.
The shelves. Gone. And it was a long time before I found any yogurt that I could enjoy. So, you know, these things happen, and they happen to me. I want you to know that it's, you know, my solipsistic view of the universe, where everything revolves around me, it does, only negatively. It's negative. If I really love a restaurant, if they have a dish that I adore, the dish will be discontinued. Dan Dan Noodles at P.F. Chang. Oh. I love Dan Dan Noodles. Not on the menu anymore. Because I loved them. They looked and they saw, oh, Card is buying our Dan Dan noodles. Why do we have this on the menu still? Shame on us.
Somebody just sent me a recipe for what she calls Ben Ben noodles. They're supposed to be like Dan Dan noodles, but the chef was named Ben. I've got to say, when you said that about the Wallaby yogurt, and I'm speaking with Orson Scott Card, you're listening to Louis B. Free Radio Show, Brain Food from the Heartland. I'm just absolutely loving that. I love your sense of humor. I don't know if you have Aldi's, the chain grocery stores where you're at, but it's, I believe, a German-based company, Aldi's. They had a chocolate soy milk that I loved. I mean, I could literally drink a half gallon of it a day. And I was always stocked up on it. And then it wasn't there, and it wasn't there the next week. It wasn't there the next week. And I asked, and they weren't sure at the store, and they were going to check at the where. They discontinued it. It was the best. I mean, it was so much better
than the
high-end brands. I mean, the Silks brand didn't – none. I have not found a chocolate soy milk as good as Aldi's generic, their house brand. And, of course, they – you and I have a lot in common.
Look, orange juice. I'm an orange juice snob. I grew up on the frozen concentrate orange juice that my family would reconstitute.
Yeah.
I thought that's what orange juice was. And then I began to buy more fresh orange juice, which was great. But it's all, no offense to Florida, it's all Florida oranges, which are kind of not good. California grows Valencia oranges. And so when I'm in California and I get fresh squeezed in a restaurant, it's wonderful, but you can't get that in stores, especially not in North Carolina, where I live. And then Tropicana came out with an orange juice that was labeled Valencia, and oh man, it was brilliant. For 3 months, I was in heaven. And then guess what? Tropicana stopped making it. It was not my local
I'm
store.
I'm not laughing at you.
Yeah, no, you are laughing at me.
I am laughing. I'm laughing at
you. I laugh at myself. But then, recently, in Earth Fair, one of the local health
food
stores.
I know Elf. Yeah,
they started carrying Evolution brand cold pressed orange juice, and it was even better than the Valencia had been from Tropicana. It is perfect orange juice. It's better than I can squeeze at home, because even when I chill the oranges and I squeeze them, they're still not whatever blend, whatever mix of oranges they use. It's perfect. So naturally,
no.
Earth Fair stopped carrying it. Naturally. However, Whole Foods
still has it.
But the discouraging thing is that they've stopped putting an expiration date on it. So I go into Whole Foods, and I have no idea how long it's been there.
Sure.
But then I tell myself, anybody who's ever tasted this is buying it and stocking up on it. So if it's here in the store, it must be really fresh. They could only have restocked last week. So I buy it drink it anyway. And if it's too old to drink, I don't care. It tastes great. So if it kills me someday, if I die of an overdose
of bad
orange juice, it'll be Evolution brand, because it just tastes so good.
So it's,
now that I've said this over the air, now that I've said it and it's out there, Whole Foods will look at this and go, well, Card buys
it.
got to get rid of this. And we thought we had a quality product, but Card's buying it, so forget it.
Oh, God. I, the similarity, I Orson Scott Card, I love your sense of humor. And I think a lot of people probably can relate. I can relate on a lot of levels to a lot of the things that you're saying. And when it's gone, you're just traumatized, I guess, a bit.
I wish that the curse were reliable. Or I would buy a lot of okra for a while just so stores would stop carrying it, because it's the most vile substance known to man. However, I know it won't work, but that's the one where if I buy a lot of okra, they'll double stock it. So, you know, these things happen. But it feels like sometimes the finer, there was a restaurant in Greensboro when we first moved here. It was Le Rendezvous. French restaurant, one of the best French restaurants I've eaten at, and I've eaten at French restaurants in France, okay? I've eaten at the Moulin de Mougins. I've eaten at some magnificent restaurants in France. And Rendezvous was wonderful. It could have held its own. But the chef, who was French, the thing that he made that I loved was a kind of a beef stew, sort of cooked so long it was all shredded. And it was amazing. It was a Parmentier, perfectly seasoned, and I ordered it every time I went there. Why would I order anything else while they had Parmentier? Yeah. And here's how far the chef was willing to go to stop giving me what I want.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I know. We don't want to be laughing when I say the next sentence. Because he suddenly died. And the restaurant closed. The restaurant closed just so that I could never have a Parmentier again as long as I live. I've talked to French chefs about it, French trained chefs, and I'll say, do you make a Parmentier? And they'll go, what? Because it's not something that you can order on the menu and they can cook it up in a pan. Oh. It's something that has to be cooking all day. Yeah. And so the chef has to be committed to Parmentier in order to have it ready, and therefore nobody does it. Even in fine restaurants in New York and L.A., I ask, "Does your chef make a Parmentier?" And they'll say, okay. "Never heard of it."
And he took the recipe with him, obviously.
Obviously, I think every copy was in the coffin, just to make sure that it wouldn't spread. Okay, now sometimes things happen. My Aunt Delpha made fudge. And it was the best thing about your birthday. My parents, my family, they would try to get wonderful presents. We loved it. But the best thing was that on every birthday, Aunt Delpha sent us a box of her fudge. And we'd leave it in the fridge, and we would try to make it linger, but it'd be gone within 2 days because you couldn't stop eating it. It was the best fudge ever made. Mild, not these one of these hyper chocolatey things. It was perfect. But then it's not that she passed away. It's that she moved from the farmhouse she'd been living in with a gas range into a new house on the same property with an electric range. And with the electric range, she didn't have a sliding scale. She could get the gas to exactly the right temperature to make her fudge. And she couldn't get the electric range to do it, and she stopped making it. And so for the last several years of her life, there was no more fudge. When I visited her, no fudge. But then I was at her family's reunion, her kids. They invited me to come, and that was great because they're double first cousins. Their dad was my mom's sister. Their mom is their dad was my mom's brother, and their mom is my dad's sister. So we have all the same grandparents. So their family reunion feels like my family reunion too. Sure. And so they invited me, and it turns out that one of my cousins learned how to make Aunt Delpha's fudge and served me some, and it absolutely was the right thing.
Well, see, things have changed. Things have changed. The universe, it's changed, Orson Scott Card. Things have changed for you.
Now that I know that it can be obtained, now it's time for me to die. Okay. The universe has said, okay, you can have all the fudge you want for the rest of your life. I know that means only about 6 more weeks. So
well, I'm really glad we're doing this today.
Yeah, you have no idea the deadline we're under. for a conversation.
Oh, that is that's hilarious. So you should eat a lot of that. Get a lot of that fudge and
well,
eat as much of it as you can.
I don't want to eat too much because I am a type 2 diabetic. Oh. And my doctor is disgusted at the fact that I am really not good with my diet. He wants me to get more exercise than I do. And so I'm working on it. But, you know, we baby boomers, we're now middle-aged, older, getting fat. That's why there's an epidemic of type 2 diabetes.
Truly.
My parents' generation, my dad ended up with adult onset diabetes as well. And he got to the point where he had to inject himself with insulin. Oh. But then by dietary control, he got himself back down to a level where he did not have to do that. And he spent the last few years of his life without any insulin injections with no problem with diabetes.
That's wonderful.
And I would like to get that same result, but it takes getting up, exercising. You know, I read things where they say, well, the average adult walks 7,500 steps a day. I'm self-employed. To get to work, I have to get out of bed and walk out my bedroom door and into the door of my office, which is the next room, and I'm at work. Now, how many steps am I going to have to take? I don't even have to drive to work. And so my opportunities for exercise, I have to make time to do it. On Fitbit, they try to get you to get 10,000 steps a day. That's a dream. So I went into the software and reset it so that it gives me all this big congratulations and all that at 5,000 steps, and that happens about six times a year. Because it's just, where am I going to walk to? I live in America, which means everything is driving distance, and that's your only choice. My neighborhood doesn't even have sidewalks, so you take your life in your hands on the street anyway. And so I when I was healthy, when I was running, I would run to the gym that was in the same shopping center as our grocery store. I would run errands, literally running them. And even then, I couldn't get 5,000 steps every day. I mean, 10,000 steps every day. And so, you know, it's just one of those frustrating things is that we have made it so that our whole civilization is oriented toward killing us with diabetes. Our civilization means, you know, I have so many friends who got really desirable properties where you have to go through the gate and then wind and wind around. I have one friend who I swear lives at the very tip, inside tip of a corkscrew. When you go to visit him, you have to double back about three times to finally get to the cul-de-sac he lives on. And I said, look, if there's ever an emergency where you have to get out of town, you're going to die before you get to the end of your neighborhood. Wow. And he laughs, and yes, it's true. Because we have so many people who think that the best real estate is to have something with no traffic. It's so much safer. The same people will buy a trampoline for their kids, meaning that they do want them to die, or at least be crippled. If you love your children, you don't own a trampoline and you don't let them anywhere near one. But nevertheless, they want so much safety that they live on a cul-de-sac. If you go visit them, there's nowhere to park. Because on a cul-de-sac, all the curb space is driveways. And so there's nowhere to park. I hate them.
Maybe
why
doesn't
do they
want,
buy that house?
Doesn't want visitors.
You know, I got to say, I grew up in an America. I grew up in towns that had grid downtowns. It's one of the things I love about visiting Old Town Alexandria, besides going to the Torpedo Factory Art Co-op, which I adore in Old Town Alexandria. It's Old Town itself. All these old townhouses, not subdivisions, just houses with a narrow gap between them, so the kids could have a Ray Bradbury dandelion wine childhood where best friends could create a little message system between their bedroom windows because there was 6 feet between the houses. And that life puts you right on the street. And there are sidewalks, and you can walk everywhere. Everywhere is within walking distance. Where is that America? Where did it go? They took it away from us, and they didn't ask me.
No,
I want to live in a place with streets, with a grid of streets where you can walk anywhere, where every kid in the elementary school is within walking distance of every other kid in that elementary school, where, you know, I grew up walking to school.
As
about
did I.
2 miles. 2 miles. And, it, you know, I had to leave 20 minutes to a half an hour early. It might not have been a full 2 miles. I've never clocked it, but it felt like,
it was a,
you know,
yeah,
five.
It was a distance. I know what you mean.
But it meant that just getting to and from school, I was getting exercise. And now, if you're not driving your kid to school, it means that you're giving them something primitive like a school bus. But no way is anybody walking. When I pointed out to my kids that they now lived within walking distance of a high school, the one that they were going to attend, they looked at me like I was insane. They said, "Dad, we're already geeks and dweebs. Why in the world would you want to destroy us socially by having us arrive on foot?" Because if you arrive on foot, you might as well rubber stamp "loser," tattoo it on your forehead. It is over for you, because cool kids all arrive in cars. And, you know, even if it's your parents dropping you off, as long as they don't yell, "Love you, honey," as you're walking away.
Or say, "Wait, I got to give you a kiss before you go into school."
Right? "Oh, no, I forgot to hug you this morning." No, you don't. There are ways that you can shame your children where they'll never come home. I mean, if that's what you want to do. But making them walk to school. So here's what my son would do. He inherited enough of my physical type that he can put on weight. And so if he found himself getting a little soft in the middle, he would skip lunch and run the track at high school during his lunch hour. And he'd do that for about a week and a half. And then he was back in shape. And he, you know, his plan was to never get fat. He had my example in front of him. Don't get fat like Dad. And believe me, that was my lesson to them. It's so much harder to lose it than to never gain it. And so he would that. But he wouldn't walk to school, which would have been absolutely guaranteed. Kept him in trim all the time because of social pressure against it. We pressure each other to be unhealthy.
Well, that's a good point. You can stay on with me a little bit. Can we keep going a little bit?
We'll go as long as you want.
I'm telling you, I'm loving this. I'm going long today, folks.
If you start getting call-ins saying, "Please shut this guy up," believe me, I understand that. So,
no, not for you, Orson Scott Card. Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to Louis B. Free Radio Show, Brain Food from the Heartland, going long today. So we're staying. I'm digging in, and we're gonna
do
this.
I was afraid you were going to ask me something substantial, because...
Thank you.
No, I mean, we're talking about life. We're talking about American life. Instead of... I mean, do you realize that until... right now, when I'm about to say it, well, I'm not going to say it. Neither of us has mentioned the name of the president.
No, we have not. Do you?
Neither of us has referred to the more common word for boundary. Neither of us has talked about the vertical surfaces of buildings.
Yes.
We have not said anything. Words referring to a particular opinion of politics. Do you realize... who knew this? It's possible for grown-ups in America to have conversations that don't revolve around hating people. How is that possible? Surely you and I must hate somebody, either different people or the same people, but here we've gone this long without mentioning it, except that I'm referring to it now, I guess.
Well... your point is well taken, Orson Scott Card, because when you think, one of the things that I've said, and you and I are in the same age group, same generation, I can remember going to, again, be at a coffee house, sitting in a park somewhere, or at a bar, and getting into really loud discussions, yelling. You could be yelling at somebody about, "I can't believe you think that." And then you'd say, when you were done expressing your opinion, hearing theirs, going back and forth, you say, "Okay, are you picking me up for work tomorrow?" You put your arm, "Love you, bro. See you. We're getting together on the weekend."
Let's go ahead and get together for a game of Trivial Pursuit with the family.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Because you're still friends.
Yes.
Having different opinions doesn't mean you can't be friends.
You didn't say unfriend me. You didn't unfriend people.
Yes. If you express an opinion now, at the end of the conversation, they try to get you fired from your job.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Because if you have that opinion, you are not entitled to earn a living in America. That's where we are. And the arbiters of this, the people who think they know who should not have jobs. I remember when I was young, when there was a big deal about Angela Davis, the University of California, who was an avowed card-carrying member of the Communist Party and a professor at a state school. And there was a lot of outcry about it, but she did not lose her job. But now, there are opinions, I'm not going to list them, because it would just make people think that I have them, and I don't have them all. Some of them not. But if you have some of the list of forbidden opinions, you should be fired from your job. That's an ugly, ugly thing. It's an ugly time in America. That's the way Russia ran things. Yeah. Under the Communist Party, if you were a dissident of any kind, because the government controlled all employment, they're the only job you could get is for the government. If they said you're not hireable, you weren't.
That's it.
And from
we're
then
done.
On, you had to live on the charity of your friends. If they could set aside little food for you, if they could set aside the necessities of life, then you could not die. Otherwise, dead.
And it's sad where we are in America. And I agree with you. I've loved the conversation, not talking politics, not enjoying each other. And one of the things.
Well, let's face it, Louis. Chocolate milk is more important to most Americans on any given day than most of the political crap that dominates the news. But start, you were saying something, and I talked
no,
about it.
No, I agree. And all these, please get that chocolate soy milk back in. I know they won't, because back to where we started, because I started to like it. I'm sure something happened in the universe that said,
that's
no
right.
more for you,
that's
Louis.
Right.
You're not getting any of that.
Look, I feel a disturbance in the force. Louis be free is having chocolate milk that he likes.
That's it.
Let us find this milk and put a stop to,
it now. like they did to the chef, the French chef for you.
I know. If I had known that I had put him on a cancer hit list, I would have stopped eating the Parmentier just to save his life.
And in my head, it's like, Louis, you're laughing at that? You're laughing? Horses Gone Car said, had I known I was going to put him on the cancer hit list, and I'm... I'm laughing at that.
We're the generation now. The people of our generation, our friends are dropping like flies. Cancer's one of the big ones.
Yeah.
And chemo diabetes. Now allows people with, I mean, it used to be an immediate death sentence. Yeah, if they said the word cancer, your first question was how long?
How long? How long have I got, Doc?
Yeah. Yeah. And now with chemo, my sister-in-law, who was our assistant, our secretary or whatever, and manager of our magazine, got cancer, and she lived on chemo and kept working, kept living for so many years. We began to think that it wasn't going to get her. It did eventually get her in the end. But the thing is, we're in the generation now where we're starting to lose our friends.
Yes.
People that we know. It's not my parents' generation anymore, because they're mostly gone. My wife's parents are still alive, bless them.
Wow.
I'm so glad. They're both in their 90s. But we know that at some point everybody dies. And so we're old enough we can be joking about it now. Now if I hear a 30-year-old joking about it, I'm gonna be upset.
Sure.
I'm gonna rebuke them. I'm gonna make them feel guilty. But you and I, there's enough gray in your hair and there's enough gray in mine that we are entitled to make jokes about dying.
It's one of the things that you almost take, and I mean this literally, in last December, taking stock of who died in the past year. I mean, it's a discussion that only people our age and older have. It's like you start to look back and you think, well, he died, she died, and it's that reality. You're right.
Yeah, at the Oscars, the in memoriam section. I remember when I was younger and they would do that, I would vaguely know the names of all these old actors. Now, part of that was because old actors had a hard time getting work in those days. Now they do a better job of staying in the public eye. But now, when I see who died. I go, must have been a drug overdose. They were so young. Only now it's they're people my age, and it wasn't a drug overdose. They just got old, and I realize, oh yeah, they're just going to die of death, it doesn't have to be some tragic he died too young situation.
I'm talking with Orson Scott Card. When you were talking earlier, stop sent with the hate mail for me. Why are you laughing at that? Why are you, it's funny, folks. Lighten up. I mean, have some joy in life.
Look, I've already had my first stroke. I know what I'm probably going to die of. I'll either die of another stroke, like my grandfather did, and at my age, younger than me, actually. One grandfather died then. The other one lived to his 90s. Or I will die from the after effects of the stroke because my body placement is no longer accurate. I lurch to the left. I lean left. I'm not aware of my body position. So if I'm out on the street walking or running, when I'm not paying attention, I find myself in the lane of traffic because I have moved to the left. Either that or tripping over the curb, depending on which side I'm on. And so I'll die of that. I'll be hit by a bus. Because I stepped in front of it.
A school bus. A school bus.
It's the only buses that run on our street. So absolutely a school bus. Look.
See, they say that the exercise, so, and you can say, I can't jog, I can't run, I can't walk because that will kill me.
I do it anyway. The real problem is that lurching to the left thing is a problem on the treadmill. Because the treadmill is safe, but I have to hold on both sides. And when I'm holding on to the arms of the treadmill, then Fitbit doesn't register my steps. And so I can do 30 minutes on the treadmill, and Fitbit thinks I was sleeping. It doesn't give me sleep credit, but it certainly does give me credit for all my steps. So I finally found a trick. I keep Fitbit on my off wrist, my left wrist, so I can't pump my arms or I'll step off the treadmill to the left. But I put my right hand on the arm of the treadmill and then do my normal arm swinging with my left hand, and then Fitbit knows I'm walking. It's just amazing how, it's like I don't even feel like I really slept unless Fitbit tells me I slept. And so, my Fitbit Ionic has been my watch now for a year. And it just died. It stopped communicating with my devices. And so I fortunately own a second one. I'm going to install that today. But for the last 3 days, Fitbit tells me I haven't slept at all.
Haven't slept, haven't walked, haven't moved, right?
Basically, the odd thing is that now and then it will register a step. When I walk barefoot, Fitbit does not know I'm walking. Because when you're barefoot on a hard floor, and we pulled up all our carpets, hated them. So you're barefoot, even on a wooden floor. You don't strike with your heel the same way you do when you're wearing a shoe. In fact, the tendency is to start to walk like a ballet dancer, which is odd, except that I did stage movement and dance when I was in college. I had a different body then, and so it was not as ludicrous as you might think. But I was in theater, and we had classes in dance. It was something. Stage movement was something we needed to do.
Yeah.
And so you walk, leading with your toe. The ball of your toe, of your foot, goes down first, and then your heel, so that you don't get that harsh impact on your Achilles tendon as it wraps around your heel. So. The muscles there, they don't have enough padding. That's why I use the protolis insert in my very comfortable Zero shoes, because I need the padding. So when I'm wearing shoes, I strike the ground in a normal way. Fitbit knows I took a step. But when I'm walking through the house barefoot, I step on the balls of my toes like a dancer, and Fitbit apparently thinks I'm a swan. And gives me no credit for my steps.
Wow, you think about the devices, Orson Scott Card, and things like that, and you think if Fitbit didn't register any movement for a few days, it would alert somebody.
It should be my life alert,
You've fallen and you can't get up.
But see, I wear this device voluntarily because I chose it myself and because I really do love keeping track of those things, but my wife's parents there's no way we can get them to wear a life alert thing.
And then again, they're
we'll
in their 90s.
To them and they go, I'm not wearing that. I'm not wearing that. Now, I wear stuff all the time. I'm not happen not to be wearing it right now. But most of the time, I have a little teeny phone called an Atom. It's a complete smartphone, an Android smartphone, but it's you could fit two of them in a cigarette box, cigarette case. Not a cigarette case, but a regular pack, a cigarette pack. That's how small it is. And on it, I keep Audible. The Audible app.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's by Unihertz, a company called Unihertz, Unihertz. It's not that expensive. I had to go to AT&T on that one. We have Verizon for all our other phones, but Verizon can't service the particular system that this phone uses, but AT&T can. So it's my only AT&T phone. And I stream audiobooks on the phone. And so, and the great courses, I can do them too. They stream to phones. And so I am either, right now I'm listening to one of the great courses on U.S. military history by, forget his name, the general who ran for president in 2016. He ran for the Republican nomination, and was crushed immediately, but that general. And it's really quite a good course. A little light on the earlier wars, but accurate. I've studied them way more than he went into, but he's great on Vietnam. He fought in Vietnam. He has memories. He has stuff to tell. And so it's been exhilarating. But I can carry that with me everywhere. I can travel with it now. I mean, I'm such a spoiled baby. I don't have to grocery shop with my mind thinking about the grocery list. That's why I have to write it down now.
Yeah.
Because my mind is on whatever the book is talking about. I just read Diane Setterfield's book about Tales from the River or something. I can't remember the title well. That's the one thing about audiobooks is you don't actually pick them up.
Yeah.
So you're not reminding yourself of the title. But it's Diane Setterfield who wrote The 13th Tale and Bellman and Black. Brilliant, brilliant novel. Slow. And this one is slow also. But I don't have to put it down. I am filling my cart with yogurt while I'm being told
not wallaby, though.
Setterfield's story. Right?
Not wallaby
no,
yogurt.
No wallaby, alas. But I found that wallaby still makes a kefir a drinkable yogurt that
wow.
I can get at Whole Foods. So I'm back in business.
Again. Aren't you afraid now that's going to disappear? I'm wondering now that you said Orson Scott Card, you mentioned AT&T using AT&T. You know, we may read in the Wall Street Journal tomorrow morning that AT&T has closed
well,
their drawers.
If that company can go under, then you know it's me, okay?
Yeah,
you know.
Absolutely.
Because there is no force in the world of business that could do it except for my hideous luck with products that I love.
If I may, the audiobooks, and people encourage me to do the audiobooks. I can do that for pleasure, but if I'm reading for an interview, if I'm reading, I hate to say for work because
it's prep.
I've got influenza, the 100-year hunt to cure the deadliest disease in history. Dr. Jeremy Brown is going to be on with us next week. You know, I need for some reason I need the physical book. I make notes in the call, you know, and it's different. But the audio books for leisure has got to be wonderful just to be able to walk and listen.
Put sticky note tabs into the book so that it sticks out to index it. My problem is that when I'm reading for that purpose, then I end up marking every third page, so it's useless.
Yeah, that's
if you mark too many. When you're reading and you're going to be in an interview, naturally with the regular book, there's points you can skim. You know, there's times you can skim. You can't skim an audiobook. You can set it sometimes to a slightly faster pace, depending on your MP3 player or your reader. But that only worked for me when I was using iPod Nano. But the iPod Nano, iTunes no longer supports the connection with Audible the way it used to. So I finally had to give up and install the Audible app on my phone and then the Great Courses app so that I could get those and continue using them. And so what I find, here's the weird thing, is I thought that any book I needed to read quickly, I had to read by reading the actual book. But I'm old now, And I used to never do this, but I fall asleep reading. The book falls on my face.
Yeah. I've been there.
And I doze off. My wife has been doing this for years because she needs more sleep than she gets by a lot. And so her discovery with reading books in bed is that she'll fall asleep. The book doesn't fall on her face, but she wakes up and realizes that the last few pages she read, she didn't read at all. She made them up. And she has to go back to see what really happened in the story. Instead, because she gets her dreams, she immediately starts dreaming, and her dreams get confused with the book. But here's what I found about audiobooks. Now, when I need to read a book quickly, I get it on audio. If it's an author that I don't know, if it's because the reading doesn't take up reading time. It takes up walking time. It takes up errand running times, driving time. So I'm reading it, but see, taking notes on it? No. If you're taking notes, you got to have the physical book.
Physical book. For me, when I read Orson Scott Card, and my wife can't stand to see me do this, is I will get up and pace with the book.
While reading
with a pen in my hand. And
I would bump into the walls on the left side, so I can't do that.
Yeah. she says it looks so awful. You know, that she said, I can't watch you do that. They're just, you know, back. It's not like I've got a length of floors or like, you know, I'm going way down a hall and coming back. You know, she said, can you please do that? Can you please go downstairs and do that? It just, you know, she feels badly for me to be that, you know, and if I get hyped up and want to read, that's sometimes how
Look,
I do it.
If you are really gripped by a story, that need to physically move is real.
Yes.
And for me, that gets satisfied by the fact that I'm walking around while I'm listening to an audiobook. Now, the problem is that only works when you have an excellent narrator. Because there are some narrators that just aren't that good. And the reading that they give can be kind of annoying. And when that happens, it becomes intrusive. And I give up on the book. I won't, you know, if I want to finish it, I'll buy the hardcover or the paperback, and I'll finish it in print because I can't put up with the narrator anymore. That's why my daughter's career as an audiobook narrator, she kind of instantly became a favorite. She has a youngish voice, so she's often used for YA, for young adults.
Yeah, young adults.
Novels, because she sounds like the age they want the protagonist to be. And she'll probably always have that voice. Maybe not. Maybe one day she'll become an old crone. But she doesn't smoke, okay? She's a Mormon like me, and so smoking's not in the picture. And so she's not doing the horrible things that smoking does to people's voices. And so she may keep that pure young sound for a long, long time. And then, of course, there are things you can do. Because I have learned long ago how to sound like a child. How to make my mouth small. I'm not doing baby talk. I'm saying everything correctly. But you make your mouth small by raising your tongue and pushing it forward in your mouth. So you sound like the voice is coming out of a much smaller mouth. And so you sound like a child. There are things you can do to do different voices. But she doesn't have to use any of those tricks. She's just great. Look, the audiobooks, I just have to recommend audible.com, even though they're now owned by Amazon. Yeah. And even though I used to be able to buy audiobooks and give them as gifts to people. And then Audible discontinued that. You can't buy a book for somebody and give the book. You have to buy a membership and give them a gift membership. Now, with that membership, they can choose X number of books, depending on how many credits you buy. But not necessarily the book you are trying to give them.
I see.
And when I give somebody a book, I don't go, here, have book. I go, here, have this book. And so Audible just lost thousands of dollars of business from me because I used to give audiobooks as gifts at Christmas. And now I can't because they stopped doing it.
Wow.
Isn't that an odd thing?
It is. I would think it would be wonderful to be able to gift someone an audiobook.
A particular book. I would like to be able to give out some of my books that way. I think the best book I've ever written was a Christmas book called Xana's Gift. It's the most true to what I like to write. I'm actually not a sci-fi writer at heart. What if I could have my druthers, I'd be writing romantic comedy. I would be, but nobody will pay me for that. Not because I've tried it and failed, but because I still need to sign up, have contracts in advance, and the only thing anybody wants to see from me is science fiction or fantasy. And if the word Ender can appear on the cover somewhere, so much the better.
Ender's Game so internationally popular.
It is.
So I get
the sequels
that.
Sequels less, but they sell better than the things that are simply off that course entirely. But you know what? I'm lucky to have Ender's Game. So you'll hear no complaint from me about that. I'm not Arthur Conan Doyle, eager to kill off Sherlock Holmes, because I know which side my bread is buttered on. And Ender's it's child labor. This poor little kid is still working so hard for me, you know, 25 years after I wrote the book. So you know, I'm not complaining about it. But there are other books of mine that I'd love to be able to have to say to somebody, look, let me send you Xana's Gift. Let me send you Homebody. Let me send you my novel Lost Boys. It's my only autobiographical novel. It's really personal, but I'm proud of it and I love it. Let me send you that. Let me send you Enchantment, which is my book about marriage. It's what marriage means. And it's also a retelling of the Sleeping Beauty story in the contemporary world.
Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the idea came from somebody else. My film company, such as it is, we had acquired the rights to a scenario, just the opening of a screenplay where Sleeping Beauty is discovered in a clearing in the woods in Russia by an American graduate student. And there was nothing after that. That it went nowhere. But in order to keep the rights, which were essentially given to us, we had to have a screenplay. We had to develop it. So I wrote it as a novel. And it's one of the best things I've ever done. But the premise is that the kid who finds her is an athletic Jew, and yes, there are athletic Jews, but he's a Jew in Russia. Before 1988, actually in Ukraine, but in those days it was the Soviet Union. And he's the one who discovers Sleeping Beauty, sees a vision of her, sees her surrounded by leaves, just this you know, autumn leaf-filled meadow.
Wow.
And she's right in the middle of it, on a raised platform, and she's lying there, and then his family moves to America. They're part of that exodus of Jews that came in the mid-80s, or maybe it was a little earlier, but anyway, his dad gets a professorship at Cornell. They go to Cornell, but then in grad school, he's been studying Old Church Slavonic, the pre-Russian language, and he goes back to Ukraine to study it, because, you know, Kiev in those days was the heart of Russia, of what became Russia. And so people talk about Ukraine as if it were an afterthought or a new country. No, it's older than Russia. Russia's the newcomer. Ukraine is the original Russia. And so he goes back, and he can't avoid it. He can't stop himself. He's become a runner in college. He was on the team. He was good. And he runs through the woods and comes to that clearing and wakes her up. Now, there's a lot more to it than that, but he then goes, there's a magical bridge that appears from the island that she's on over a moat that was filled in and covered with leaves to her world. And in her world, he's a weenie. He's an athlete. He's a runner. He is in perfect physical shape by Western standards. But in her culture, if you can't pick up a two-handed sword and lop off somebody's head in a single blow, what kind of man are you? And so she, because of the spell that was on her that made her sleep, she has to marry him. But they plan, the people of her kingdom, plan to kill him as soon as the wedding is done. They get her back, then she'll marry a real man. This is taken actually from real Russian folklore, because Russian folklore has all the same motifs as Western folklore, except meaner. So the Russian version of Sleeping Beauty has exactly, you know, not Western Sleeping Beauty, but the young man, wakens the princess, marries her, and then she tries to kill him because she wasn't in on this bargain. And so Russian folklore, when you read Russian folklore, it's all so grim and depressing. You realize, no wonder they needed vodka. These are the stories they were telling on long winter nights. And without vodka, how would they get through them? Just, you know, the sheer grimness of them. So I kept the spirit of the Russian folktale, kept the spirit of the Jewish folktale. Sure. All Jewish folktales, apparently, at least from what I read, revolve around one issue. Somebody makes a covenant, inadvertently breaks it or forgets they made the promise, and then everything goes wrong. They're punished until they keep the original promise. And it's all about keeping oaths and covenants, which when you think about it, that's
sure.
That's what Torah is.
Yeah.
Is oaths and covenants. It's what the book of Judges is. It's half of Kings and Chronicles and the book of Samuel. So those covenants are important. So I have the keeping of covenants, that marriage covenant. They marry against their will. Neither one wants to marry the other. But they are able to magically come back to America at one point. Baba Yaga, the witch of Russian folklore, follows them. She hijacks a 747 and takes it back into, you know, 7th century Russia. So that the hut of Baba Yaga, if you know the Baba Yaga legend, it's that she lives in a house on chicken legs that rotates so the door faces wherever she wants it to face. Is that a 747 on a runway or not? And so Baba Yaga's hut is the 747 she hijacks and brings back, and then he ends up saving the people who are in, breaks the spell. They get to go home, but that's Baba Yaga's hut forever. So I'm playing with folklore. I'm having a lot of fun with it. But at the same time, it's about these two people who are married and then gradually fall in love. And I'm just proud of it.
Oh, I hear that. That's beautiful.
Put all the love for my wife into that book. So I still get a little emotional thinking about it because it means so much to me. But it doesn't have Ender Wiggin in it. So
but that's a beautiful...
There are readers. It's sold decently and it has a good audience, but it's an older book, so you can only get it in paperback now, but I would love to have people give it a try, especially people who don't think they like sci-fi. I've written so much that isn't science fiction. Don't read something by me that's in space if you're not interested in it. Read Enchantment or read the Alvin Maker books, which are set in an alternate version of the American frontier, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, I have so many people who say to me, "Oh, Mr. Card, I love your book. I've read it so many times." And I go, "Which one?" Now, I know they mean Ender's Game. I'm not an idiot. But which one of the 75 books I've published are you referring to? And they're always stunned because they had no idea that there were that many. Now, do they immediately rush out and read the others? No, because Ender's Game satisfies a hunger that's in many young readers, many older ones too, but many young readers. If I knew how it worked, do you think I wouldn't have done it again over and over? Come on. I like making money. I like pleasing my readers. But I don't understand why it works. I just know that it does. I'm grateful that one book in my career has had that effect. And other books have done well. I could live on what the other books earn, but Ender's Game holds up the tent. And any writer who complains, you know, if J.K. Rowling ever says, "Oh, if only people would realize that it's not all Harry Potter." And we know she's a whiner and a weeper because of her...
Go ahead.
Because of the court case where she sued the guy who basically made a concordance to Harry Potter that she herself had used online. But heaven forbid somebody else should take the money that was rightfully hers. And so she cries on the witness stand, I think, richest woman in the history of the human race. And she's weeping because some guy was going to make $2,000 or $3,000 off of her Harry Potter universe by performing a service for all scholars who are going to have to do research and write about her book. It was the most selfish, shameless thing I've ever seen. And so my contempt for her as a human being came right then. I just realized there's not enough money for this woman. And yes, she had hard times when she was young.
Okay.
So did I.
Yeah.
So did I.
A lot of us have. Yeah. No. That's no reason. That would be a reason, I would think, to open your heart and be more giving and more generous than close it and behave as she did.
You know, I would think that she would have said, hey, reprint this and let me write an intro and talk about how I used your online resource and how I appreciate and am proud of what you've done to support my fiction. I mean, that's what a good person does. Instead, she did the other, sued the guy, ruined him, won her case by weeping. And I'm sorry, as soon as a woman's in an argument and she cries to win, she has lost my respect. I grew up a feminist, a real one, not the mock kind but the real feminist where they really wanted women to be taken seriously instead of being whatever, baby coddled, whatever you want to call it. And so I have lost friends over that. We've been in a discussion. It becomes a good argument of the good kind. We would still be friends afterward, except when she can't answer my point, she cries. Now, the discussion's over. You can't have an argument with a crying woman because it makes you look like a jerk.
Sure.
So it's done, but there will be no future conversation. I'm done. She has disappeared from my life. And that's only happened a couple of times because most women don't do that. But when somebody does that in an argument, when a woman goes to the tears to win, then, you know, that's like stabbing you in the back with a snee when you thought you were fighting with rapiers. So it's just one of those things that I have little patience with. Now, I don't try to get her fired from her job for being a weepy woman. And the Harry Potter books are still as good as, and at points as bad as they ever were. They haven't changed a bit. I still enjoy the movies. I still watch them and go, what incredible luck they had casting these Harry Potter films, because who knew that these kids would grow up to be able to act? And they did. Neville, who was cast to just look like a dweeb, was a man in the last film. And the actress playing Ginny, she turned into a human. Who knew that would happen? Harry and Ron and Hermione, they were smart kids. They read lines well. That didn't mean they were going to grow up to be able to act.
Sure, that's.
But they all did so well. What incredible luck. The only other long series of films I've seen with similar luck is Game of Thrones. They cast people who were still so young that they had no idea what they would grow into. The younger sons in the Stark family and the Baratheon family, the Lannister family, those who know the story know who I'm talking about. The younger sons, one of them named Rickon, the other one named Tommen. They had no clue whether these kids would be able to act when they got older. And they were outstanding. Talk about being blessed by fate, by the casting gods. They did not have a loser in the bunch. And everybody grew into their part. So those two are remarkable. The fact that I don't have much respect for J.K. Rowling as a rich person. I don't have that much respect for most rich people I've had contact with. I don't have respect for the kind of people who are prone to say, to think that they're entitled to special privileges because
they're affluent
or because they have money. If I want a special privilege, I'll pay for it if it can be bought, and I'll do without it if it can't. And if I can't afford it, then I'll do without it. And so that's what you're supposed to do. And this is going to be the first time these words have fallen from my lips. I would be ashamed to ever say, do you know who I am?
Oh.
That is just, for one thing, if they don't, you're not as famous as you thought. So if you ever have to say, do you know who I am, then you don't deserve to say it. You're not that famous. And I recognize, I've known all along, that the only fame I have is writer fame. You know, when Jack Palance wrote a book of poetry and published it, he could sell books by just showing up at the bookstore because he was famous as an actor and as a one-arm push-up doer at the Oscars. And people would buy the book just to get the autograph. But anybody who's going to show up at a signing for Orson Scott Card is somebody who was going to buy the book anyway, because the only people who know or care who I am are people who already value my writing. So they were probably going to buy the book. So we don't sell any more copies by my doing a book signing. What we do is we bring people into the store and help the store look like and feel like a good community place, a place where readers gather and get to know each other, and a place where things happen. So we do signings. We authors who are only known for being authors, we do book signings not to sell copies, though that's nice when we do, because we're selling only books we would have sold anyway. We're there to help the bookstore love us. So any author who goes into the bookstore and treats the clerks and the bookstore workers badly,
yeah,
and snipes at them or complains, those books, their books will never be face out on the shelves again. They will all be spine out. They'll still carry them,
yeah,
but they're not going to give them that face out display that is vital for somebody just picking up a book because the cover looked interesting. If no one sees the cover can't do its job. And I've known of authors, nice people, who are nice to everybody except bookstore workers. That's the only people they're rude to. And that's the most insane thing they could do. You know, it's people who have some degree of fame, who treat ordinary people, quote, lesser people, rudely. They're not good people. You know, one of my favorite stories about Anthony Hopkins, this is a famous guy, Oscar winning, in popular films, unforgettable human being. When he gets to a set, he arrives early, before the shooting starts, early, like several days early, and he tours the set where painters are working and construction, everybody's working on building the set, the costume makers are stitching, and he goes up to each person. And one at a time, he sticks out his hand and says, "Hi, I'm Tony Hopkins." As if he had to introduce himself, yeah. But he never acts like the kind of person who thinks everybody's going to know who he is.
I'm glad you shared that about him, because I love his acting and didn't know that. I agree with you, Orson Scott Card, about when you say that about people. One of the things I always love to do, and am I going too long? Can you go?
I'm here.
I'm loving this. So if
I'm
you're
having a great time.
Thank you. I'm honored by that. When you say that, two things. I've got to say, I was at a restaurant once where someone was requesting a table, and he said, "You obviously don't know who I am." This was in Pittsburgh, and I burst into laughter. I didn't know who it was. I just thought that it was hilarious. My wife was, uncontrolled laughter.
I
lost it.
I agree with you completely.
It was hilarious
to me.
That's
exactly the right response. Okay, so let me give you the opposite person. I'm at P.F. Chang in Santa Monica. And I'm sitting in a, you know, there are no bad tables because they're going to put P.F. Chang food on it. So, you know, all tables are good. And they do a good job of isolating the bathroom. So you never get that, you know, odor at your table. There's no bad table. And a family group starts assembling, and it's fairly near the door because that's where their big table is. And it's Tom Hanks's family. Colin Hanks is there, Tom Hanks is there, quite a good group of people. Now, this is LA or Santa Monica,
yeah.
So nobody goes up and asks for an autograph, nobody makes a fuss. We all know they're there, but what I also see is how unfailingly polite he is.
It's wonderful.
To the wait staff, even when things go kind of wrong, when someone makes a mistake, when some item is not brought as ordered. He just very kindly was pointing it out, never showed temper, never took umbrage at anything, because he's a good guy.
A mensch. And,
yeah.
A mensch.
And,
yeah.
A mensch. That's the, and so... You, and there are plenty of those. There are lots of good people in Hollywood.
I'm sure.
Just like there are lots of wonderful, kind producers. It's just that none of them has the ability to green light my movies. So.
I have to say this. When you said about people, one of the things I've done and urged people to do, to call or ask for a manager. If somebody treats you well, or, you know, get a manager and compliment, or call the store and say, tell them, compliment that person. And I hear this every time, and I dare say I set it up a little bit. I'll call and I'll say, may I speak with the manager, please? I have a comment on one of your employees. And they'll say, please hold. And you can almost hear the drop in their voice. And then the manager will get on the phone and say, hi, how can I help you? I said, well, this is a manager? Yes. I wanted to tell you about one of your employees. Do you know who Scott is at the second register? He was so polite to me. He said, this is a compliment. I said, yes. I wanted you to know. And they don't get that. They'll say the same thing every time. People never call to compliment, or rarely call to compliment. And I don't get that. If you're going to complain about bad service, why wouldn't you compliment what you consider exceptional service? And those people are out there that exceptionally serve. I encountered one the other day and asked him. There was a product. He took time. He stopped what he was doing. He went in the back. It took him a while. He had to break down a pallet, but he came out with the unsweetened soy milk for my wife. I mean, I went to a manager on my way out and thanked them. I said, Jordan in the dairy and produce department was exceptional. And the other thing about that, if you don't mind, if I continue for a moment.
By all means.
Everybody has a bad day. You don't know when you're going through a line at a grocery store, a store anywhere. Someone may have just had a family member that died, had a cancer diagnosis. You don't know. And that person may just not be as up that day. And someone might just, a complainer, might just want to complain. And if in that file they've got compliment after compliment after compliment about that person, the manager's going to look at that and know that that's either a real complainer or not. I'm sorry, I'm going on.
Compliment after compliment, Louis. It takes one.
One, yes.
One compliment is so rare. I mean, you're a unicorn, my friend. You're a unicorn. You are rare. You are rare. Now, I will talk to people on the way out of the restaurant and say, wow, service tonight was so good. Everything was wonderful, you know. But I have never called after the fact. I almost never go online when they give you a little go online and do it. Well, here's what I do. I overtip obscenely.
That's beautiful. That's a way you can do it, though.
I had friends when I was in college. I had friends who worked as waiters who were treated badly. My friends were working at a restaurant called Chuck-A-Rama in Utah. It's a chain of smorgasbord restaurants where people go in and they don't feel like they need to tip because they got the food themselves at the bar.
I see.
And so they lived. They still got paid waiter salaries, which means
way less
than the minimum wage.
Yeah.
But they weren't getting that many tips. And so I tipped well there, even though I didn't have that much money myself as a college student. But ever since then, in memory of their suffering, I never punish a waiter who does a bad job by stiffing them on the tip. Here's how I punish them. Instead of tipping them between 40 and 50%, I'll tip them only 20%. They have no idea they were being punished. They have no idea. And that only happens if they're overtly mean in ways they didn't need to be. But if somebody's just forgetful, I remember that my daughter was once a trainee waiter. And she tried her best, but she made mistakes. And I treat them the way I would want my daughter treated.
That's beautiful. That's somebody's kid. That's somebody's somebody. And again, you never know what's
somebody's mother or somebody's, you know, brother or whatever. Somebody's kid.
When you mentioned about bookstores, one of the things that I always say on the show, and I love having authors on, I'll say, the book is available everywhere and everywhere online, but please try to buy it as close to home as possible at a local bookseller. I obviously independent bookseller preferably. but even the Barnes & Noble, the chains, because that's where the people in your community work. And,
right.
And
Barnes & Noble has basically killed all the other bookstores in town. They do that.
Yes.
But I don't want to punish them because of Barnes & Noble and in the old days, Borders.
Borders.
Every town of any size in America has a great bookstore.
Where local people work.
And if they stop making money, if Amazon clears them all out, I've been in an Amazon bookstore. They have a few brick and mortar stores, and all they consist of, all they sell, are the top six books that they're promoting online anyway.
Sure.
They don't have a selection. You can't browse in that bookstore. It takes about 30 seconds to see every title they have, and they're the ones you already decided not to buy on Amazon. However, having said that, I must say, even though I love Barnes & Noble and that's where I do my signings, we have a great relationship with our local Barnes & Noble. I have a great relationship with the chain as a whole and also many independent bookstores in towns that still have them. But I also love Amazon. It is the best department store that ever existed.
Because I understand that.
I can do all my shopping while putting my butt in a chair and not getting 5,000 steps that day.
On your Fitbit.
And I can send gifts that they will wrap and send to me in a respectable form and that people know, that it's not just a machine doing it, that you cared enough to send what they had to offer. I love the fact that if there's a product I realize I need, something that I'm about to run out of or just ran out of, if I order it on Amazon right now, I will have it tomorrow. Very rare for me to find something that is not there immediately. And they decided that they would, use books as their loss leader. They never expected to make their money from books. But what they did was they made their reputation at delivering immediately in good condition. And those deliveries, that's what made Amazon. Then anything else you bought from Amazon, you also expected and trusted that it would arrive in good condition very quickly. And so now I order all kinds of products through Amazon as a marketplace, as an old-timey department store. Most people don't understand that department stores, even now, the perfume counter is not owned by the store. That space is leased to the company that sells perfume. And various other concessions are going on inside that department store. But the original concept of the department store, back when ZCMI, Zions Cooperative Mercantile Institution, basically invented the department store in Salt Lake City, it was just a big building, a co-op, in which all kinds of merchants came together. They were inventing the department store or the shopping mall. Either way, it didn't matter. They were all under one roof, and then when they consolidated so that you would check out in one place, but everybody would get their money. That made it so that everybody could thrive and build on each other's business. Amazon does that.
Yeah, I understand.
And most of the small dealers of books who used to have to rely on mail orders and sending out catalogs, which is so expensive to do, they now piggyback on Amazon. Amazon gets their cut, but it's not a huge cut. And Amazon thrives because it makes their business possible, too. And so Amazon is greedy. They make monopolistic decisions all the time. When they bought Audible immediately became a little bit worse, and the audiobook industry became a lot harder for everybody.
And Whole Foods also.
I'm stunned that Whole Foods has not already done terrible things to make their service less inclusive. It was Amazon's acquisition of Audible that ended up killing their individual book gift cards. So, I blame that on Amazon. They make decisions sometimes that I don't like. Having said that, I love them anyway. I'm still a regular customer, and I'm not stopping because they have reinvented retail, and they've made it better.
And I'm not anti. I didn't want you to give the impression I'm not anti Amazon. I love when people order the books of the authors that I have on, but I know that the local stores are where the local people, your friends, your neighbors, their neighbors' kids are working.
Now that every bookstore is also a coffee shop, you can go there and spend some time. Now there's a bank that's advertising that they're becoming a coffee shop. Stupid idea. Nobody wants to go and have coffee at a bank. But at a bookstore, there's stuff to browse.
Yes.
And of course, during Christmas, Barnes & Noble became the best toy store in town, too, now that Toys R Us is gone. All kinds of games and toys. It was great. It meant there was less space for books. But you know what? They're not going to carry all the books. They can't compete with Amazon for depth of category. And so they don't try. But you can go into Barnes & Noble and see stuff. Browse and see
That's
stuff.
Right. And you're looking at a book and you see something else. That process of discovery. It's like, oh, I wonder what that is. And let me look at it and pick that up and take it. And I love that.
Me too.
I love the browsing. Can I ask you two more?
We'll
go to the top of the hour, about another 5 minutes, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Do you mind if I ask you how you speak so beautifully about your family, about your wife, and you're talking about the book, Xana's Gift. How did you two meet? Do you mind if I ask how you got together?
We were, every Mormon ward, that's what we call our congregations. Every Mormon ward is determined geographically. You go to the one you live in. Exceptions are extremely rare. They have to be cleared in church headquarters. Okay, so it's totally geographical. You don't shop for a church. You go to the one that your house is in.
Okay.
My parents and her parents were in the same congregation. And while I was doing my... I directed a show, a little amateur musical, 10-minute musical that I wrote. It's a tradition in the Mormon church. We call them road shows. I directed one right before I went on my mission. My future wife was in the chorus. I knew who she was, but I wasn't dating anybody. For heaven's sake, she was still in high school. I was in college, and I was going on a mission. And so while I was on my mission, my mother ran a program of drama for the youth in our ward, in our congregation. And they put on play after play, and my future wife was the mainstay, was one of the most loyal and active and talented actors in the group. So when I get home from my mission, my mom has already set it up so that I will be directing Brigadoon, the musical. So I basically get off the plane and hold auditions. And it was a no-brainer. Christine was going to play the lead. She was going to be Fiona in Brigadoon. I cast my younger brother as her love interest, the Gene Kelly role, because he was the best. But my mother had already set it up for me to have a date with Christine when we first arrived. My mom picked her out for me.
Wow.
I am in an arranged marriage. Now, it took about 3 years of courtship with a couple of breakups, etc. So it's not like the traditional arranged marriage. It wasn't just
I understand that,
together.
Yeah.
But we both tracked it and realized that long before I knew that I was being set up with Christine, she was being set up with me.
Wow.
So my mom, bless her heart, decided she knew who I should marry, and she was right. What I valued about women, of course, Christine is an attractive human being. She's lovely. She has a warm personality. She's an extrovert. She's good with people. She's also not only smart, but rigorous. I would date girls, and it was always on the last date I ever had with them that this sentence got uttered. Oh, I don't know how you got to be so smart. How do you know all these things? I'm not interested anymore in that person. But when I said something, some interesting fact that came up in the conversation, she would answer, "Where in the world did you get that?" And I had to source it for her, because that's the way her dad, a historian, helped her deal with questionable information that she got in school. Because there's so much crap taught in schools.
Yes.
By under or miseducated teachers.
Undereducated or I agree.
And because after all, where are they getting their degrees? In our horrible, politically charged universities.
I agree.
So what do they actually know about the real world? So Christine grew up with a dad who said, I wonder where... He wouldn't say, what an idiot, about something that a teacher said. That's just wrong. He would say, let's try to find out where he got that. Let's try to find out his source. And that's what Christine brought to our marriage. She brought it to our kids. Our kids have been raised in that mindset. Not to yell at somebody for being wrong, but instead to find out where the idea came from and find a path to better information. And so She was not only the smartest but the most intellectually rigorous human being I had ever spent time with. And I'd have been insane not to marry her. And I knew it. I bought a diamond for her the first Christmas we were together. We broke up twice since then, but I never thought of giving that diamond to anybody else. It was her diamond. And when I finally gave it to her, I knew that I'd been holding that. I knew all that time that I didn't want anybody else raising my kids. She was the only candidate for the job, and if I could talk her into doing it, man, I was the luckiest man on earth. So, song by Ben Folds that plays in at a key point in the brilliant Richard Curtis movie About Time. Luckiest, the luckiest. I am the luckiest. That's how I feel about her.
Do you mind if I hope you don't mind this observation. It makes you a little emotional. I mean, it made me a little emotional. You're telling me.
Well,
that's beautiful. That's beautiful.
The weepier I get.
And me too.
Death has touched my life a few times. I can't talk about either of my children who have died without getting weepy. And so I don't. I don't talk about them because most people are made uncomfortable by that. Because, you know, people tell you time heals all wounds. No.
No.
Time just makes it so that you can get through the day without crying in front of strangers. That's all. And it's as fresh 18 years later as the week when my son died. It's as fresh 21 years later as when my little baby girl died in the hospital before we could bring her home. Those things don't fade. Never. And anybody who thinks they should, anybody who ever says, and people have said this, not to me, but to, I've heard them say it to others, aren't you over that yet? Oh, man.
Oh, that's the worst, right?
Yeah.
That's the worst. When you say that, Orson Scott Card, it makes other people uncomfortable. It's not for them to be uncomfortable. It's not their pain. And
the pain they're suffering is the pain of embarrassment and of being afraid of saying the wrong thing, which leads them to say the wrong thing. Years ago, when we were first married, I had a hard time going to funerals. And they were my parents' generation or older who were dying. But I just was uncomfortable. I would avoid going to the funeral, even from somebody that I really cared about. And I was talking to a friend, an older fellow named Bob Laird. My wife and I were talking with him. And I said, I can't go. I don't know what to say. And he says, look, nothing you say will make them happy. Nothing you say will take away their grief.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what you say as long as you don't say something like, are you still crying over that?
Or I know how you feel. That's the one.
Oh,
that,
man, that's a
like,
terrible
right?
one. Because even if you had had a child die,
you don't know how someone else is
to lose
feeling.
My child.
Yeah.
And so you know, it's you, as long as you're not saying something really offensive, all you need to do, and this is what he said, show up. Just be there. And a touch of your hand, a hand on a shoulder. If it's somebody that you, if the grieving people are people that you know, all you need to do is be there. I remember what it meant to me when our baby died. And my publisher showed up to the funeral. I was blown away. It moved me so much. I hardly had time to talk to him. I wasn't going to pour my heart out and cry on his shoulder, but he showed up. And do you think that I'm going to be changing publishers anytime soon? He's my publisher for life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's how you show love and friendship, is you show up. You're there. And, you know, every parent who goes to every stupid soccer match that their kid does a terrible job in, or every band concert where the instruments are out of tune, those parents know showing up makes all the difference. My dad didn't care about music that much, but he was at every musical I was in. He was at every band and orchestra concert. He was there. Never missed him. And I knew he loved me. And that's how you do it. You know, you're just there. You just show up.
That is so. I'm not going to ask you another question because that was so beautifully said, and I'm so honored that you shared that from your depth. that resonates, and it's that that's, and I obviously I agree with you. You've got to be there. But when I'm so grateful that you gifted me and my audience with this time today. I've got a stack of things that questions I was going to ask. I've got my homework over there. And this
well,
was
I'll
just
come back whenever you ask me.
Seriously,
but,
you
oh,
would?
Of course. I've come every time you've invited me. So my absence for years is because you didn't ask. I'm not going to invite myself onto your show. I'm not going to call up and say, "Hey," I'm not going to email you and say, "Louis, you haven't invited me," because I don't want to be the guy that you're desperate to never have on again. and they still keep showing up.
This was such a beautiful time with you. You know, I have to say, we started, almost 2 hours ago, an hour and.
I don't have a clock.
I don't know. It's about 5 after 1 Eastern,
okay.
And I think we started at 11. I don't know.
15.
Yeah. And I have to say, we started, and you started with such wonderful humor. You started. You flowed with just wonderful humor.
Well,
you just cracked me up.
But you're being very kind.
No,
but
excuse me. I'm being honest.
I know you are. But the audience, they know their own opinion of our conversation at that point. they don't need us to review each other. But I'm comfortable talking to you because I don't feel like you're trying to score points off me. You're not here, you know. A talk radio network guy once explained to me how talk radio is supposed to work. He said, "It's all about selling the star, the call-ins, everything. It's all about making the star look good so people are delighted. They identify him as a brand name, and they want to come back and listen again and again. And you know what? That's the way most talk radio is. But it never feels that way with you. When I'm with you." It feels like an actual, real-life conversation with a human being who is listening to what I'm saying and who has cool things to say in reply. That's the way I think it should be done. And so I'm glad that's what you do.
Thank you. I'm honored by that, Orson Scott Card. And just, again, starting with the a wonderful, humorous conversation and getting to the depth that you allowed. That you shared, it's really a gift, a gift.
Well,
and
Louis,
I mean that.
I understand that, and I will just tell you that laughing and crying, Joni Mitchell's song. Laughing and crying, it's the same release.
Yeah,
they're only about an eighth of an inch apart. Many things are miles apart, like talking and understanding, but laughing and crying, just an eighth of an inch apart.
And I'm honored to have been able to laugh and cry with Orson Scott Card today.
And I appreciate you giving me the chance.
I'm honored by it. Thank you from my heart. Thank you so much. This has been incredible.
And we'll talk again. We'll talk about stuff that makes us both mad. How about that?
And maybe at some point you're going to say, "Okay, Louis, you've invited me too often. I'm not doing it next time."
Look, that would be almost impossible because you won't invite me more than your audience can stand because you take care of them. So it'll work out fine. It certainly won't be more than I can stand. So we'll be fine.
Thank you. I've loved this. Thank you so much.
I've had a great
Thank
time.
You. Thank you. Orson
we'll
Scott.
See you.
I will be back with some closing words as soon as I get it together. Oh.